Dreams, Evolution, and Value Fulfillment. Volume 1, A Seth Book. By Jane Roberts. Notes by Robert F. Butts. Preface by Seth. Private Session, September 13, 1979. Preliminary Notes by Rob. Seth actually began his preface for this book, Dreams, Evolution, and Value Fulfillment, with the next 881st session, which Jane delivered for him 12 days later on September 25. I chose to present this private session first because in it, Seth offers certain information about Jane and me that I think applies to all of our work with him through the session and books, and to our own separate creative lives as well. Especially do I like to interpret his material tonight as meaning that Jane is a psychic or a mystic. For to me, at least, this means that in this physical life, she's chosen to penetrate as deeply as she can the depths of reality or consciousness. The session, the 878th, was held on September 10, 1979, and it began at 9:07, Monday, just 5 regular sessions after Seth had completed his work on Mass Events, and 3 before he began Dreams. Earlier that day, I'd made a wadded-up paper ball for Mitzi to play with. Using her lightning-quick reflexes, she kept knocking it around the living room and beneath Jane's rocker as my wife went into trance, then began to speak. Here are session excerpts. Seth, good evening. Rob, good evening, Seth. Seth, observing the antics of your Mitzi gives me an excuse to begin the topic of the evening, animal consciousness. I want to begin simply by having you question some concepts taken quite for granted to question much. It is somewhat fashionable to see man as always nature's despoiler, as the destructive member of nature's family, or even to consider him apart from nature, who is given nature as his living grounds. It is somewhat fashionable to see man as the creature who dirties his own nest, and I am not condoning much of man's behavior in that regard. However, there are other issues and questions seldom asked. You ignore the fact that, overall, the consciousness of animals has its own purposes and intents. It is true that animals are slaughtered under the most cruel of circumstances for human consumption, and then they are treated simply as foodstuff. Buffaloes do not roam as they did before. There are thousands of farm-bred animals, however, and have been, all throughout civilization, alive for a time, well cared for a time, animals who in usual terms would not exist except for man's gluttonous appetite for meat. It is the way the issue is often considered. It seldom occurs to anyone that certain forms of animal consciousness came into physical form by choice, that certain species are prized by man and protected, or that the consciousnesses of some animals had anything to do at all with such an overall arrangement. You cannot say that such animals came out ahead of the bargain. But you can say that the species of man and certain species of animals together formed an arrangement that did have benefits for both. Man is more a part of nature than he realizes, and in the greater realm of activity he cannot take any actions with which the rest of nature does not agree for his own reasons. Remember, here other material given about cellular communications, for example, and the vast web of intercommunication that unites all species. Of course, animals can communicate with man, and of course, man can communicate with other species, with all species. Such communication has always gone on. Man cannot afford to become aware of such communication at this point simply because your entire culture is based upon the idea of the animal's neutral subordinate position. The men who slaughter animals cannot afford to treat those animals as possessors of living consciousnesses. There is beneath it all an important unity, a sense of communion, as one portion of the earth's living consciousness dies to ensure the continued life of all nature. That natural sacrament, however, turns into something else entirely when the gift is so misunderstood and when the donor is treated so poorly. Basically, many farmers love animals for themselves and delight in their ways, But by itself, delighting in animals is not considered particularly virile enough. If you like animals, you must not like them for yourselves, but for other reasons. If you want to be with animals, then you must become a farmer, or a veterinarian, or a cattleman, or whatever. Many animals enjoy work and purpose. They enjoy working with man. Horses enjoyed the contributions they made to man's world. They understood their riders far more than their riders understood them. Many dogs enjoy being family protectors. There are deep emotional bonds between men and many species of animals. There is emotional response. Dolphins, for example, respond emotionally to man's world. The animals on a farm are emotionally aware of the overall psychological content of the farmer's life and that of each member of his family. Consciousness is filled with content, many kinds of consciousness. The farmer's animals understand that in a certain fashion he is a midwife, responsible for some of their births. Food comes from his hands. The animals understand on their own that life, on any terms that are physical, end with death, that the physical properties must be returned to the earth from which they came. Animals do not blame human beings for anything. If, as a species, you really found yourself communicating with the animals, you would have an entirely different culture, a culture that would indeed bring about an alteration of consciousness of the most profound nature. You have forgotten, conveniently, how much you learned from all of the animals, as I have mentioned in past sessions. You learned a good deal of medicine from watching animals' behavior. You learned what plants to avoid and which to cultivate. You learned how to rid yourself of lice by going into the water. You learned social behavior by watching the animals. At one time, you could identify with animals, and they with you to a remarkable degree. They have been your teachers, though they did not choose your path. Obviously, you could not have gone your way as a species had it not been for the animals. Domesticated animals have their own reasons for choosing such a state. It is, for example, usually enough to think that your cats, Billy and Mitzi, should ideally run outside in the open, because in the wild, that is what cats would do. Cats in the wild were, in those terms of time, exploring one kind of nature. In that kind of nature, with a natural population taken care of in the environment, there would be far fewer cats than there are now. Your cats would not exist. Why does it seem anti-natural, even slightly perverse, for a household cat to say, prefer fine cat food from a can, when it seems that he should be eating mice, perhaps, or dining upon grasshoppers? The household cat is exploring a different kind of nature, in which he has a certain relationship to human consciousness, a relationship that changes the reality of his particular kind of consciousness. Your cats are as live in all ways inside of the house as out. They understand their relationship with your human reality. They enjoy contributing to your life as much as any wild animal enjoys being a part of its group. Their consciousnesses lean in a new direction, feel about the edges of concepts, sense openings of awareness of a different kind, and form alliances of consciousness quite as natural as any other. Rub notes. Now, Seth discussed a couple of other questions Jane and I had and then ended the session at 10:27. Continuing Rob, inevitably, Seth's specific references to cats had reminded me of certain other intriguing passages of his in Mass Events. I found I'd presented them therein as excerpts from non-book sessions in sixth chapter. Both of the following quotations from that material contain vast implications, and should these ideas ever become well known, Jane and I feel they'll be sure to arouse the deep opposition of a number of vested interests. From session 837, there is no, quoting Seth, there is no such things as a cat consciousness, basically speaking, or a bird consciousness. In those terms, there are instead simply consciousnesses that choose to take certain focuses. End quote. Rob, from session 838, quoting Seth, if there is no consciousness tailored to be a cat's or a dog's, then there is no prepackaged, predestined, particular consciousness that is meant to be human either. Rob, then reminiscing almost 3 years later, 1982. Once more, as I've done often in recent years, I've expressed the hope to myself that, in another probable reality, very similar to this one I opted for, the outdoor life in a much stronger way, even to living outside night and day for most of the year. I must be doing so right now. In that probable life, I use a tent sometimes, but I cook and sleep outside as much as possible, except in the worst weather. What a different life. I'm still a painter, I often think, but perhaps not a writer. I might be a Milton Avery or a Paul Cézanne type of artist. More and more I've come to admire, revere even, the single-minded, childlike devotion artists like Avery and Cézanne had for their art. Not that I want to copy Cézanne, for instance. I couldn't even if I wanted to. But in that other reality, I too chose to live the natural life in a more native or clear-eyed manner. To sublimate myself before nature while at the same time trying to become master of whatever means of expression I can achieve. How strange a desire to have in these days of scientific and religious turmoil, of computers and nuclear debate and space technology. It's almost like trying to wish oneself back into an earlier, seamlessly less complicated time. That surely would be an illusory goal. But no matter what we may accomplish as a species, or how far we may travel, in those terms we started out utterly dependent upon our Earth, with its fantastic variety of resources and life forms. That sublime framework still exists for us in all of its great beauty, and I want to always return to it. We create our human version of it each day. And I think that even now, we've hardly begun to understand what we are and have. Now here is the private session, listed at the beginning of these advance notes, the one I chose to present just before Seth's actual preface for Dreams. The opening notes that follow are pretty much as I wrote them before Jane began delivering the session on Thursday evening at 9:40. September 13, 1979. With amusement. Comments? Rob. Okay, good evening, Seth. Seth. The two of you thought of yourselves specifically as a writer, or rather a poet, and an artist, before our sessions began. I would like to clear up some important points. You identified primarily now as a poet and an artist because those designations up to that time seemed most closely to fit your abilities and temperaments. Rupert's writing set him apart. Your painting set you apart. These were recognizable, tangible proofs of creativity. You therefore identified with elements, characteristics, and traditions that seemed to suit you best. To some extent, you had your own niches, recognizable by society, even if they were relatively unusual. You did not know that there was a deeper, older, or richer tradition, a more ancient heritage to which you belonged, because you found no hints of it in your society. It seemed at different times since our sessions began that there were disruptive conflicts. For example, was Rupert a writer or was he a psychic? Were you an artist or weren't you? What about the writing you did, both for our books and the writing you sometimes plan to do on your own? Those kinds of conflicts can only exist in a society in which the entire concept of creativity is segmented, in which the creativity processes are often seen as inner assembly lines leading to specific products, a society in which the very nature of creativity itself is largely ignored unless its products serve specific ends. Rupert was correct in his introductory notes for Mass Events today about the poet's long-forgotten abilities and his role. Rupert has been a poet all of the time in the most profound meaning of that term. For the poet did not simply string words together, but sent out a syntax of consciousness, using rhythm and the voice, rhyme and refrain, as methods to form steps up which his own consciousness could rush. Early artists hoped to understand the very nature of creativity itself as they tried to mimic Earth's forms. Poetry and painting were both functional in ways that I will describe in our next book. And aesthetic, But poetry and painting have always involved primarily man's attempt to understand himself and his world. The original functions of art, meaning poetry and painting here specifically, have been largely forgotten. The true artist, in those terms, was always primarily, in your terms again, a psychic or a mystic. His specific art was both his method of understanding his own creativity and a way of exploring the vast creativity of the universe, and also served as a container or showcase that displayed his knowledge as best he could. That is the heritage that both of you follow and have followed faithfully. It is an honored tradition. Also involved is, as Rupert correctly picked up from me, a group of accomplishments that we will call the psychological arts. You are involved in those also. I want you to specifically understand that there is and can be no conflict, for example, between your writings and painting, for in the most basic of ways they represent different methods of exploring the meaning and the source of creativity itself. The sessions I give you, in usual terms, are a new extension of that creativity, but again, that extension has an ancient heritage. Your own writing, of course, is art. It is also a method of perceiving and understanding creativity. It is a method of learning that redoubles upon itself, and you are uniquely equipped to discover comprehensions from a standpoint that is most unusual. Explore, for example, your own feelings toward me, whether or not they have changed through the years, how much I seem to be myself, or part Jane, or part Rupert, or part you, or part Joseph, or whatever. Realizing that you are in a position you wanted to be in, and realizing that your abilities are not in conflict with each other, nor you with them, will automatically fulfill and develop all of those abilities in a new kind of overall creativity that is itself beyond specifics. Now, when Rupert begins to trust himself as he has, the physical arthritic armor loosens. The creative abilities become even more available, hence his new creativity and the new physical steps he has taken. They all go together. He believed in the specific nature of the creative self so that it could only be trusted in certain areas. He believed he needed strong mental barriers as well as physical ones set up against his own spontaneity. He is beginning to understand that the spontaneous and creative aspects of personality are the life-giving ones. They can and must be trusted. He knows now he does not have to slow down, and that relaxation leads to motion. He did indeed pick up from me a partial list of subject matters to be covered in our new book, which will be called Dreams, Evolution, and Value Fulfillment. The book will necessarily, of course, include much material on the true nature of creativity and its uses and misuses by civilization. You do not have to fight to trust the thrust of your own life. That thrust is always meant to lead you toward your own best fulfillment, in a way that will benefit the species as well. When you trust the thrust of your own life, you are always supported. Tell Rupert that. I want you both then to understand that in the greater light of creativity, understanding its true meaning, you have taken the right course and therefore drop from your minds any lingering ideas of conflict and doubt. Such a stand will automatically clear up all problems involving things like taxes, sex roles, or whatever on both of your parts. You, both, are studying the nature of creativity as few others have done or can do, and that is bound to make possible new creative frameworks and to offer new solutions to situations that cause difficulty only within smaller frameworks. Do you have questions? Rob: No, Jane's been doing great lately, and I'm very pleased to see that. Seth: He should, meaning predictive. He will. End of session. Rob: Thank you. Seth: A fond good evening. Rob: Good night, Seth. Preface: Dreams, Evolution, and Value Fulfillment, a Seth book, Volume 1, Section 881, September 25, 1979. Good evening. Rob: I laughed. Good evening, Seth. Seth: Preface: This book will be my most ambitious project thus far, period. It may be said by some that any book at all is an ambitious endeavor, when it originates from a psychological source, so far divorced from your ordinary ideas of creativity. It is one thing, for example, for a physical writer to produce a manuscript, and even that kind of creativity involves vast and hidden psychological maneuvers that never appear in the manuscript itself. As most of my readers know, I make no claims of now having a physical personhood. I do claim an independent reality at another level of existence. My status and origins seem strange only because you have understood so little about your own origins. I am beginning this book this evening. I have already given the title, and at another level of consciousness, Jane Roberts was able, 12 days ago for example, to perceive some glimpses of some of the subject matter that will be included here. So far, however, physically, there is only the page of paper upon which Robert Butts is writing down these words I speak. Somehow, in terms of time, there will be a thick book. Although the manuscript does not yet exist in a physical book, the book itself, the ideas and words are, in the most important fashion, quite real now. Certain qualities are implied in all kinds of creativity that are generally overlooked, and so they are not apparent. The kind of creative procedures we are involved in can serve to bring some of those qualities to light and to shed illumination upon many aspects of the human psyche that usually remain hidden. I speak through Rupert, or through Jane Roberts, if you prefer. Rupert has his own creative abilities and uses them well, and it is to a large extent because of those abilities that our contact first took place in December 1963. Scientists like to say that if you look outward at the universe, you look backward in time. The statement is only partially true. When you move inward through the psyche, however, you do begin to thrust, in your terms, backward, toward the origins of existence. Your creative abilities do not simply allow you to paint pictures, to tell or write stories, to create sculpture or architecture. They do not simply provide you with a basis for your religions, sciences, and civilizations. They are your contact with the source of existence itself. Now give us a moment. They provide the power that allows you to form a belief system to begin with. Now, while you believe that consciousness somehow emerges from dead matter, you will never understand yourselves, and you will always be looking for the point at which life took on form. You will always have to wonder about a kind of mechanical birth of the universe, and it will indeed seem as if your own world was made up of the spare parts that somehow fell together in just such a fashion so that life later emerged. You are filled with the questions about when and where the various species appeared, and how the rocks were formed. When some reptiles grew wings, when some fish emerged from the oceans and learned to breathe air, and you are bound to wonder what happened in the times in between. How many reptiles tried for wings, for example, and failed, or could not fly? Or how many millions of reptiles did it take, and how many trials before the first triumphant bird flew above the landscape? How many fish died with only half-formed lungs, who were too far from the water's edge to dip again beneath the waves? Or how many fish flopped backward to the water, finding themselves in such an in-between stage that they could no longer live in the water nor breathe the air? So in those terms, how many water dwellers died before the first mammal stood securely with fully completed lungs, breathing Earth's early air? Scientists say now that energy and matter are one. They must take the next full step to realize that consciousness and energy and matter are one. Give us a moment. In this book, then, we will look at the origin of the universe, the origin of the species, the origin of life from another viewpoint. This viewpoint will, I hope, provide another framework through which you can understand and study physical reality, your part in it, and sense the immense creative complexity that unites each individual with the source of consciousness itself. I do this, I hope, to explore a more meaningful concept of evolution, and that concept must involve a discussion of subject reality and its effect upon the evolution of man's consciousness. The universe did not originate from what you like to think of as an external objectified source. Your own physical body provides you with sturdy corporal images, exterior presentations. Your dreams do not suddenly appear exteriorized upon your images in place of your features, for example. They remain hidden. Your dreams appear on the interior screen of your mind. I never want any of my remarks to be construed in such a fashion that it seems I am in any way negating the fullness, validity, and magnificence of physical existence. I do want to point out, however, that a state you usually call dreaming is but a dim indication of an inner reality of events, an inner order of events from which the physical world emerges. I hope to show how the nature of dreams has helped shape man's consciousness. I hope to show that consciousness forms the environment and not the other way around. I hope to show that all species are motivated by what I call value fulfillment, in which each seeks to enhance the quality of life for itself and for all other species at the same time. This further unites all species in a cooperative venture that has remained largely invisible because of beliefs projected outward upon the world by both your sciences and religions, generally speaking. All of your grandest civilizations have existed first in the world of dreams. You might say that the universe dreamed itself into being. Now, give us a moment. Generally speaking, the states of waking and sleeping are the only levels of consciousness with which you have been primarily concerned. It seems to you that this is the result of your evolutionary process. But there have been civilizations upon the earth that specialized in the use of many focuses of consciousness. For, as example, you are focused upon the use of tools. Dreams can be highly specific. They can be used to provide sources of information. I hope to show their practical importance, both as a part of man's evolutionary development and their possibilities in what you think of as modern life. The answers are where you have least looked for them. The universe is still being created, even as each person is in each moment. End of preface. That should make Rupert feel better. And give us a moment. Rest your fingers. Will you open that wine? Rob notes, after giving a little information for Jane, Seth wound up the session. Seth, we begin again with a new book, and I am sure your own lively mind will bring questions to the forefront that will be of interest. A fond good evening. Rob, thank you, Seth. Good night.